matrix normalization group, DMRG, so I'll kind of use that term generically. I've reached a pretty amazing state of development where for two-dimensional problems, we may still be kind of stuck at finding the ground state, but in 1D, we can do quantum coherent dynamics in many cases basically exactly, which I think people would have thought was very difficult before this algorithm. So I want to mostly talk about what are some physics problems. You know, you might think 1D is fairly trivial, and on some level it is easier than higher dimensions, I'll admit that. But there are still some open problems in 1D where this algorithm lets us actually come up with hypotheses and then check them. So I'm going to talk a little bit about different points on this kind of continuum of transport, where we expect that if we had a free particle system with no disorder, things would move ballistically without scattering. It's possible that once we added some disorder, we would get diffusive transport and Ohm's law and things like that. And in the limit of strong disorder, at least without interactions, we would expect localization. So the first part of the talk is kind of in this part of the continuum. And then the second part of the talk, or the second thing down here, is about this part. And this work depended very heavily on these three postdocs and a new student in the group also, Yuchen Huang. Okay, so, and this is the kind of introduction that will really disappoint people who come from more of a quantum information background. But if you want a quick sketch for end users like me of why these algorithms are powerful, here it is. So the basic problem in trying to do numerical simulation of many-body systems is that the states that are easiest to deal with on a computer are not very good for describing reality, what the actual wave function is in the material. And a way to understand that is if I asked you to write down the simplest wave function of, say, n spins, you'd write down a product state, which basically means a two-component vector for each site. And looking ahead a bit, I might assume or impose that these are actually the same vector, so it's some kind of translation invariant state. But even if I didn't assume translation invariance, you'd see that this is still a not very general wave function because it only took me of order n coefficients to represent the wave function for n spins when we know that there are actually 2^n states in the Hilbert space. So the basic problem of quantum condensed matter from a computational point of view is that the Hamiltonians we're given tend to be local. And there's a belief, and maybe I'll sketch a little bit more about this, that local Hamiltonians generate more entanglement than this product state. If you just looked at states like this, you could compute things very rapidly, but you wouldn't capture much of the physics. But they don't generate as much entanglement as if you just plucked a state arbitrarily out of the Hilbert space and didn't use locality. So somehow the key advantage of matrix product state methods is to use locality. And the specific way that this works in 1D is to generalize the notion of a simple product state. So this algorithm goes back to Steve White, but there have been various improvements in the 20 years or so since then that have greatly expanded the class of problems it can be used for. So instead of the simple product state, I basically want to add these upper indices to make these into tensors. And these upper indices run from 1 up to some large number, we'll call it chi, that is just limited by the size of my computer resources. And there's a fancy way to write these in terms of tensor networks, and there are certainly higher dimensional generalizations and so on that I won't talk much about. I want to focus on the question of, if I view DMRG as basically a variational search for the ground state within the set of matrix product states of a certain dimension, is that a good approach? Does that work for problems we care about in condensed matter? So in fact, one kind of neat way to use this algorithm is the following. Suppose you want to study an infinite system. Usually we care about the thermodynamic limit. Well, you might try to take a larger and larger finite system. That's what you do in exact diagonalization, for example. You don't actually have to do that. If you believe that your system is translation invariant, that is, for example, the Hamiltonian is translation invariant and the ground state doesn't break that, then you don't simulate an infinite number of these matrices A. You just simulate a finite number, typically 2, and essentially impose the translation invariance. And a very elegant way to do this is in this PRL of Vidal. So you could ask, well, what happened? Where's the approximation if I'm just studying two sites? Well, you can think of it as finite size approximation has been replaced by finite entanglement. And I'll make that more precise in a second. But basically, these matrices can only keep a finite amount of entanglement because they only have finite dimension. So just to explain sort of how DMRG has come a long way, It used to be thought that gapless systems were hard, dynamical properties were hard, finite temperature is hard. They're all a little bit harder than the ground state, but at least in 1D, things are now in pretty good shape. So as an example of a simple Hamiltonian that we know how to solve and can check the result of this family of algorithms, let's take the transverse sizing model in 1D. So this has a quantum critical point at J equal to G, and this is a plot of how the errors get smaller as I increase the size of the matrix and the matrix product state. And note that computationally, it's easy to do several hundred. So these are still very small, but you can see the error is getting enormously small at all points except for the critical point. At the critical point, the errors are getting a little bit smaller, but definitely the advantage of going to larger and larger chi is not as large as it is out here. So the good thing is this is a critical point that we understand very well. It's a free Majorana fermion. So what can we say about convergence of algorithms like this, even at the worst possible case, which is the critical point? And it turns out that even at the worst case in 1D, it's not that bad. So the way this works in practice, I want to mention this because I find it kind of interesting just as a statement about the way finite matrix size works. It works just like other perturbations to a quantum critical point. So we're not perturbing the Hamiltonian. We're formally keeping the Hamiltonian the same, but we're limiting what kind of states the ground state is allowed to be, we're doing a variational calculation is probably the way to look at it. And if you do that, you generate an effective correlation length, basically because we know quantum critical points in 1D have diverging entanglement. The maximum entanglement that I can store is something like log chi. So something has to break, and it turns out that I generate a correlation length, and that scales as some power of the matrix size. And this power kappa, we don't know it rigorously or exactly, but there's a formula you can kind of derive that seems to work quite well for at least a lot of examples, all the examples I know. And the way that works, I'm not going to give the derivation, but first let me explain why there is this connection between entanglement and matrix size. So the basic idea is if I gave you a general pure state of a bipartite system and asked you to represent it over bases of A and B, then a general state, well, any state has an expansion like that, but in general, unless it's a product state, there won't be any way to write it as a product of a single state on the left on a single state on the right. Instead, I'll get so-called Schmidt decomposition, which is a sum of such things. This is obtained basically by just singular value decomposition, which is like a diagonalization of the matrix Cij I had up here. So basically, I'm choosing a nice basis for A and B, that's all. And if I do that, I can choose these numbers to be real and non-increasing. And then what I get, I can use this to define some measure of how much entanglement there is in the system, which is just, if I had a pure state for the whole system, and I only looked at part of the system, I now don't have a pure state, I have a density matrix, how much entropy is that in that density matrix? Well, that's directly related to these eigenvalues that appear here. If one of these were one and all the others were zero, that would be no entropy, that would be a pure state. So to actually use this for something, as I said, the way to think about what this algorithm is doing is sort of like an image compression where I'm not keeping the whole state, but I'm keeping the highest eigenvalues in the Schmidt decomposition, which we hope is a reasonable description of the state. And Frank Pullman made pictures of image compression using the same algorithm. So this is taking a grayscale image, treating it as a matrix, and doing SVD and keeping the largest eigenvalues. With 4 eigenvalues, you can't really see anything. With 16 eigenvalues, you can see a bridge, et cetera. By the time you get to 256, you can see it's our favorite bridge at Berkeley. So we want to do that with quantum states. And as you probably know, the way to think about critical states is they're not like bridges. Bridges have particular length scales. Quantum critical states, or critical states in general, have structure on all length scales. So some things should be a little bit different. And the way that works, and this is just a sketch how you can develop a little theory of it, it's actually, well, conjectured, let's say, a form for what is the spectrum of these eigenvalues of the Schmidt decomposition at conformally invariant quantum critical points in 1D. So this is good information because it tells us if we were to chop off all the eigenvalues past 100 or 1,000 or whatever, how much are we modifying the state? So if we do that, then we can kind of compute this critical exponent kappa, and you get this strange-looking formula where C is the central charge. This is not a scaling dimension in the conventional sense. It's the central charge of the theory which is basically a measure of the number of degrees of freedom. This is saying that the finite entanglement convergence gets a little bit worse as central charge increases. One reason for suspecting that this formula probably can't be exact is that it involves the square root of central charge, which is a very weird thing, but somehow it works, empirically it works very well. So we had some checks in our paper, and then there's a more recent paper, I assume it's published now, I just didn't look it up, that has more checks, and so far it seems like the story is that critical points are worse than gap points, but we know how much worse. So if with a laptop even, you can study them and get what you need. Yeah.
So these results are obtained from the distribution of the entanglement spectrum.
That's one of the inputs. So the basic idea, where this result comes from, at least our derivation, was I want to think about energy and minimizing the energy. And the idea is there are going to be two terms in the energy. One is the true energy of the state in the Hamiltonian, which is just dependent on the correlation length and is minimized if the correlation length is infinite. And then the other term is the fact that if I tried to put in a state with a very large correlation length, then the weight that's in the higher eigenvalues gets truncated, and that basically gets pushed into a higher energy scale, which is of order the gap determined by that correlation length. So if you balance those two terms, you get an expression for the correlation length as a function of the matrix size, and that's this exponent. So there is a derivation of this, but it's not a rigorous derivation because in particular, finite entanglement is not, it violates all our assumptions about locality of field theory and so on. There's no obvious reason why it should be a scaling perturbation, but it seems to work. But yes, it's the kind of thing that would not satisfy someone more rigorous than I am. So just as a test, I mean, for ground states, this is amazingly successful. Just to take a simple solvable ground state, we know that the XXZ spin Hamiltonian, which if you want, you can think of as spinless fermions with near-neighbor interactions, it doesn't have a Fermi liquid, it has a Luttinger liquid. So what that means is that the N of K distribution, it doesn't have a step, it has this cusp-like behavior, which is not that easy to see in N of K at this scale, but if I zoom in, this is how far I am from the Fermi point, this is how far I am from 1/2 in N of K. I get these power laws that are just what they're supposed to be. Alternately, if I look at the real space correlation functions, they agree very well with no free parameters with the asymptotics from field theory. So that's saying ground states are easy. But what I want to come back to in most of the talk now is, first of all, go to finite temperature, and second, go to dynamics. And that is harder, but what I want to claim is that there are at least a couple of old problems that we can now solve. Because of advances in the algorithm. So the first one is the following. If you like superconductivity, it might be because you're fascinated by dissipationless transport, the idea that currents flow with no resistance. And mathematically, the way that works is I've got an electrical conductivity with a delta function in it. So superconductors are a pretty non-trivial reason for that to happen. There's kind of a current carried by the ground state. There is another way, which is that I could have a current of excitations, but those excitations can't relax. And the way that happens is if I have a conserved quantity Q and the current has some projection onto the conserved quantity, then that part of the current will basically live forever. If I've got a current that lives forever, well, this is the expression for the weight of the delta function in terms of the current correlation function in time. So currents that live forever correspond to dissipationless transport. That's kind of intuitive. So a simple case to give you some idea of this would be, suppose I had a translation invariant system with one kind of particle, then if I ask about the current of those particles or the conductivity of those particles, momentum conservation means that that will be infinite. But there are non-trivial cases where we don't actually know what the conserved quantities are. And this is kind of the details of how this is not really a conventional thermodynamic quantity. It is in a superconductor where it's coming from the ground state. Here it's really, you should think of it as a transport quantity or an excited state property. Basically it's bounded below by the Meissner stiffness, which is thermodynamic. But for the cases I'll talk about, there isn't really superconductivity. Okay, so the problem is that we have a lot of models. Probably the most interesting models are cases where there are an infinite set of conserved quantities. The model is so-called integrable. But none of the standard conserved quantities has any projection on the current for symmetry reasons. And the XXZ model in zero magnetic field, which is this thing, or alternately, I could write this as spinless fermions at half filling with nearest neighbor interactions. That model was known for a while to have an infinite set of conserved quantities for at least 40 years or so, and none of them had any projection on the spin current or the charge current. So it wasn't clear whether D is zero or not, and there were claims both way. So as of 2011, for example, this is a very nice paper that kind of gave the state of the art, and I'll come back to this paper later, but as of 2011, people didn't know, does the current live forever in the XXZ model? So this was the situation at that time.
So in higher dimension, whether it's a, there's no controversy, the superconductor indeed have this non-zero weight.
Yeah.
So the issue here is in one plus one dimension, whether the scale function is still there or not.
We know cases where it has to be there for kind of simple reasons, but the controversy, I guess, was, suppose I have an integrable model, which means, in a sense, there are an infinite number of conserved quantities, and there may be very limited relaxation possible.
Okay.
But suppose that none of the conserved quantities gives a non-zero value here, which was what was thought at the time. Then does that mean that there is a Drude weight, or is there not a Drude weight?
Well, for the generic non-integral model, do we know whether there's Drude weight or not?
I'm going to come back to that. At least for this model, we can show that adding a integrability breaking perturbation destroys the Drude weight.
Oh, I see. So basically, you say that the integrable model, as you mentioned, have a less relaxation. So interparticle interaction have possibility to preserve Drude weight.
Yes.
I see. But when you higher dimension, you don't need that actually. Generically,
Generically, if you have superconductivity,
yeah.
Yes. But that's kind of, so superconductivity is really a different mechanism to me in that it's really the ground state is doing the transport. But I think, if you don't have a condensate and if you don't have integrability, then I think probably the Drude weight has to be zero. The exception would be, you know, any conserved quantity like this will give me a Drude weight. So I could fine tune, you know, that there's, even if they're not an infinite set of conserved quantities, there's just one that could be enough.
But here say that's a, In one D, you don't have a condensate, no superconductivity.
Right.
But somehow, integrability can give you
a It can, but the story is a little bit complicated.
Well, whether it's really there or not,
Well, let me say how it all got worked out.
Yeah.
Because there was some very nice analytical work by Prosen I'm going to come to, and then,
You say Meissner's stiffness. Can one associate a conserved quantity for that, like a three-dimensional superconductor? Is it possible?
Yeah, well, that's basically the energy response to a flux twist. So that's why I think of that as thermodynamic. So the Meissner stiffness is, if I were to put it on a ring and put a flux through the ring, how much does the energy change? So that's not really a transport quantity, but it gives a lower bound on the transport quantity. It turns out this paper by Mukherjee and Shastri is nice. It kind of explains that the difference is in how they treat equal eigenvalues, equal energies. There's a subtle difference between the two, but they are different. So this is where it was in 2011. It was known that the Drude weight was smaller than all the estimates based on the beta ansatz. This is how does the, in a certain way of picturing the data, zero Drude weight would be the red line, finite Drude weight would be the blue line. It was kind of on the edge of being non-zero, but much smaller than they thought it might be beforehand. So the results I want to talk about, so, this is numerical.
Oh, this is numerical.
Yeah. Oh, so sorry, the yellow line and the green line are analytic, but not right, I guess. The black line is the numerical line. Yeah, and then that's right. It turns out that the real analytic result is really quite surprising. And that's what, basically, the XXZ model is one of the oldest integrable models. And yet, there's something new about it. And this was explained by Prosen, and it kind of came out of left field, and that there's a standard way to get the normal infinite hierarchy of conserved quantities by sort of repeatedly commuting. And that doesn't give you this new quantity that he found, which he found kind of by thinking about open boundary conditions. This new quantity, there's no finite analytical form. It's kind of obtained by an iterative process, and it has a fractal behavior, basically, on the anisotropy in the model. So it's an odd object, but it seems to exist. He argued that this would give a lower bound on the Drude weight. And I'm going to show you it does a little bit more than that at some points. And then what we figured out, and this was basically because of a trick found by Christoph Karsh and Jens Bartesen, we were able to go to slightly larger time scales in the simulation, which made it possible to just read off the Drude weight. So very briefly, for people in the audience who actually do this kind of calculation, the trick just comes down to a particular choice of, this is not operator space method, this is just using extra spins and Silla spins to represent the thermal ensemble. There's an arbitrariness in how you evolve the ancilla spins with time, and it seems to work much better. So this is kind of showing that for this case, we know the exact answer. This is a different, this is like a test problem. Traditional DMRG starts to have big errors around there. If you evolve the auxiliary spins with the opposite Hamiltonian of the real spins, so if you kind of evolve those backwards in time, maybe that has something to do with, you know, Heisenberg evolution of operators. Then you get a much more accurate simulation. For us, it increased things by about a factor of 10. So what that means is that now you can just read off the Drude weight. You no longer need a complicated fit or anything like that. You just measure the current-current correlation as a function of time, and you see eventually it becomes a straight line. And the magnitude of that straight line tells you the Drude weight. And then here's kind of the surprise. If you plot this at high temperature, against Prosen's result. So Prosen's thing is normally, you know, you might think numerics are noisy compared to theory, but theory in this case is sort of non-analytic with the anisotropy, so it's kind of, it has peaks up. So we don't have any continuous expression for this, you kind of have to do the iterative process. This is the high temperature limit of the Drude weight. But what seems to be true is that in general, the real answer, which we think is our numerical answer, is above the lower bound from Prosen's new integrable quantity, but they agree at this first cusp. They're off by a percent or two there, and at first we thought that was just a problem with our numerics. Prosen has emailed us saying that he's found another in this set of new quantities that explains that disagreement. So it seems like at least at these special points, which are kind of known to be special in the integrable solution of the XXZ model, these quantities are not just giving a lower bound in the high temperature limit, they're really the whole answer for why there is dissipationless transport in this model. So it's a funny answer. It seems like integrable models have so many conserved quantities that even if you think you know all of them, you don't actually know all of them. There's this new independent set, and that's why the current is conserved.
So these commensurate points are in terms of the Jordan vector fermions, quarter filling, one-eighth filling, and so on.
Actually, no, filling is determined by magnetic field. So these are special interaction strengths. But they're basically interaction strengths.
That's when the exponent became a rational number, you know, for locking the liquid, continuous of exponent.
That's right. So at these, definitely things are rational. And also, what I think might be more relevant, so here, I think this is kind of beyond the Luttinger liquid stuff. I think it's more like the strings in the thermodynamic Bethe-Ansatz solution become especially simple at these points. I know that. Like, there's some kind of limitation on the scattering in that picture. But
the language of bosonization, the compactification radius, becomes rational
2 pi. That's right. So that was kind of the easy case, in a way. That was integrability, where we could say a lot of things analytically. So now there are a couple of natural questions, which, as it happens, were already asked, at least one of them, which is, is it really right to say that the conserved transport, the Drude weight, is because of integrability? So we can break integrability and ask what happens to the conductivity. So let's do that. And then I think what's a bigger puzzle that we are trying to resolve, even in the integrable case, it turns out there's something very interesting that happens when I try to put on a thermal gradient and study energy currents in response to a thermal gradient. So I'll say a few words about that, but there's a neat puzzle for anyone who likes integrable models. And then finally, I want to say a bit about many-body localization, what happens with disorders. So there's a very recent paper by Dmitry Abanin and collaborators that may explain some of what we see. Okay, so non-integrability, that's the idea that integrable models are very special. And the real world in 1D is often close to integrability, but we kind of expect that any real polymer system or whatever, quantum wire, is going to have some additional terms that mean it's not quite integrable. So for computational purposes, we chose to add one which is a staggered magnetic field. And the way to check that breaks integrability is the following. In integrable models, there is no level repulsion. Level repulsion is the idea that if I take two levels of a quantum system, as they move close to each other, there's kind of an anti-crossing. Statistically, they're very unlikely to sit on top of each other. This leads to what's called Wigner-Dyson statistics. It means that energy levels, if I just had an energy level at E, I have to wait a little while before I'm likely to see another energy level. In integrable models, there are so many conserved quantities that two nearby energy levels in the many-body spectrum are likely to have different values of some conserved quantity, which basically means they're living in different sectors of Hilbert space and they can pass right through each other. That means that there's no level repulsion. You get Poisson statistics. Poisson statistics is just like radioactive decay or something. It means that once one event happens, that has no influence on when the next event happens. So what we can see is that here, this is the Poisson statistics, that basically there's no level repulsion. This is the energy difference, and this is just the histogram of the number of levels. While if we turn on the staggered field H, then we get level repulsion. And there's a region of the XXZ model phase diagram where this is an irrelevant perturbation, which means it doesn't open a gap. We still have a Luttinger liquid at zero temperature, and we can actually track the RG flow by asking, this is using that thing I showed earlier on how we can calculate the power laws and the correlation function at long distance. All of these points have the same long distance correlation function, which means they're all basically flowing to the same Luttinger liquid point. So then the question is, well, normally irrelevant perturbations are called that because they're irrelevant. We don't need to worry about them. Like, this is still Luttinger liquid, but the Luttinger liquid is a free boson. It's perfectly ballistic. There's no interesting conductivity in a Luttinger liquid. So the question is, basically, is the conductivity controlled by this irrelevant operator? Because it's the only thing that can backscatter. And the answer seems to be yes. So if you bosonize, things are a little bit subtle. And I don't totally understand why the simple theory works, but the simple theory does work. What I mean by that is, this may not look especially simple, but the hard work was done by Affleck et al. So we just had to modify it a little bit. So if you take this problem and represent it, this would be the Luttinger liquid. This is a free boson. And then there are various additional terms, some of which are there already in the XXZ model. And then there's an additional term here, which is kind of a cosine in the bosonized representation. So when I add the new cosine, that has a scaling dimension, which basically tells me that as I go to zero temperature, the conductivity should diverge. This is just the charge conductivity of the fermions. The charge conductivity should diverge because the perturbation is running to zero. The conductivity should also diverge if this bare perturbation H is taken to zero. So bosonization predicts this kind of power law. And with sort of heroic numerical work, so this is, I think, the one calculation here that took more than a laptop, you actually see this power law. So you can see that if you have an almost integrable model with an irrelevant integrability breaking perturbation, then the conductivity blows up at low temperature with power laws that at least in some cases are basically predicted by bosonization. Basically, when the calculation is reliable, and for this calculation we had to do linear prediction and one or two other things that are perhaps not totally kosher. When the calculation is kind of self-consistent and telling us that it's not breaking down, then the bosonization prediction seems to work, and you get these nice power laws. So there are minor puzzles. There's one case where currents seem to live forever if you dimerize the Heisenberg chain, but we don't know why yet. But I want to focus a little bit on two bigger puzzles that will appear later in the talk. So this is one of the bigger puzzles. And this is, if you are interested in bosonization, let me just, I think I understand the answer to this, but I'm not absolutely sure. So maybe someone has a better answer. So what we did is what you could call the single operator theory, which is add this term, compute its scaling dimension, and figure that it scatters the currents of those. And that works. But if you think about it for a while, which some people did in the bosonization community a while ago, there's another possibility, which is if you remember, umclap is another cosine that doesn't break the integrability. So in general, one cosine in the field theory does not break integrability of the field theory. I get the sine-Gordon model. So the belief was that it's really the combined effect of the two cosines that should do it. So just in the field theory level, it's a little bit hard to explain our result. I think the answer is that you should think, go back to the lattice model and remember the conserved quantity that's important for the current has nothing to do with any simple current of this. And the term that we're adding definitely scatters that current. But basically, yeah, the thought was, but this seems not to be the case, that you can understand the current relaxation as kind of the synergy of two cosines. Instead, it seems like if you want the current relaxation, you shouldn't be too smart and think about it in terms of the Bose-Nyes field theory. You should just think about, you get the scaling dimension from the field theory, but remember that the current is properly the current in the lattice model. So that's a little technical thing. Now let me get to something that's very basic, and I think is kind of neat, but we don't have the analytical calculation yet, but we're furiously trying. So what I mean by non-equilibrium here, I want to create two leads at different temperatures, and I think there are a couple points where it's good to draw a picture. So at T less than zero, I'm going to prepare my system in two halves, one half at T1. And then for temperature greater than zero, I'm going to connect them. So in particular, for the interesting case, once I've made the connection in the Hamiltonian, the system is translation invariant. So there are two possibilities. It could be translation invariant like the first thing I talked about, which is integrable, or it could be translation invariant like the second thing I talked about, which is non-integrable and has a finite conductivity. And it turns out that the question of do I get a steady state for the heat current across that middle bond depends on whether the system is integrable or not. And in the integrable case, there's something very general that seems to happen. So let me explain the integrable case, because that, to me, is, if this is right, this is neat. And we know it's right in one limit, but it seems to be right more generally. So,
Let me answer your question. So, at the beginning, for time less than zero, you prepare a different temperature, although with no coupling.
That's right.
And then at time to zero, you turn on the coupling between two segments.
Yeah.
And, however, after that, the model is translation invariant and also integrable.
Yes.
Then the issue is that whether this temperature in the step would generate a constant heat current flow.
Yeah, so what we expect to happen is that there's some kind of transient related to the boundaries. And in the integrable case, there is a steady state. And the surprise is the magnitude of the steady state.
I see. But in general, one would expect the heat current would decay because the temperature gradient getting smaller and smaller.
Exactly.
I see.
So in the non-integrable case, you do get, we can't track it all the way to infinite time, but our belief is that in the non-integrable case, you eventually get a sort of Fourier law. Something like that, where there's a, and indeed these gradients are getting smaller. While the right picture for the integrable case seems to be like the following free picture. So you could think of this as just a black body radiation experiment. So if I had a ballistic system, then I've basically got right movers coming from here at temperature T1. I've got left movers coming from here at temperature T2. So for example, if these were photons, then I would have the difference between the Stefan-Boltzmann law of radiation coming from here and the Stefan-Boltzmann law of radiation coming from there. And it's actually known fairly rigorously that conformal field theories are effectively ballistic at low temperature. So for conformal field theories, you get that the current is different, is the difference between two functions that are like the Stefan-Boltzmann law, which in 1 plus 1d is t squared, and there's a factor of central charge. So the surprise is that it seems like for integrable models at all temperatures, this is still satisfied. So it seems like this is not a function of TL and TR separately. It's like there's a blackbody law. Every integrable model has its own blackbody law, would be the way to state it. And that was a surprise to us, but it makes very simple predictions to test. It's like saying that the total current between T1 and T3 is the current from T1 to T2 and the current from T2 to T3. You can check that. That's basically on this plot whether the crosses lie within the boxes. And for all the cases we can test in integrable models, that seems to be true. So integrable models, they do have a notion of well-defined excitations, but normally there's a kind of backflow where the group velocity and stuff like that in these excitations would be sensitive to what they're traveling through. So it's a bit surprising, even in the integrable model, that this F function exists, the Stefan-Boltzmann law. But we have one calculation of it from the Bethe-Ansatz and the Ferromagneta case that is almost right. It's right at low temperature and deviates by about 10% at high temperature, but we and other people are trying now to calculate, you know, if this function really exists in, say, the XXZ model, which we studied, we ought to be able to calculate it from the beta ansatz, but it's a pretty strange thing. So that's the second big puzzle for this part, that there seem to be black body laws in integrable systems, and then this is, sorry, as Xiaogang said, the non-integrable case is relatively simple, and then the third case would be, what if these are coupled by something that is like a weak link? And then we can see sort of Luttinger liquid tunneling behavior in the numerics, but there's no big surprise. We sort of know that if we've got a Luttinger liquid on both sides, then there can be unusual power laws in the thermal and electrical currents across a weak link.
Joel, does this black body temperature, is it physical temperature or some effective temperature?
It's just T1 and T2. It's the temperature at which they were initially prepared. But it's saying that it's more than just T squared. So like free particles with just one velocity, like a conformally invariant system, it has to be T squared. But in general, it's like in a lattice model, there's kind of an upper cutoff. You know, it doesn't go to infinity because, yeah, so anyway, we know what the function is. We just don't know how to calculate it analytically.
Here I have a technical question. Yeah. So since many of your results depend on this integrability law, so then there's the issue about numerics. When you do truncation, then like arbitrary perturbation may break integrability. So that's maybe limit. You can only run the simulation for so long. I mean, beyond certain lengths, the non-integrability would set in. But how do you know where you should stop? Whether your result is reliable or not?
Yeah, well, I guess the most we can do is we can increase the matrix size. I mean, we can sort of tell, you know, we'll see a straight line for some amount of time, and then in principle, we would see our errors grow and things would kind of go haywire. It's actually worth pointing out, there is a strategy. This is kind of a neat paper. I know Verstraete is one of the authors, so I don't remember the other authors, where you can actually make a sort of hierarchy of integrable equations that go so that at every finite matrix size, it's still integrable. So I don't know if that's done for this case, but it's done for something where, it's done for a boson problem. I think it's probably done for Lieb-Linegar, where you get something like Gross-Piderewski is the simple one, chi equal to 1, and chi equal to infinity is becoming the full, like, Lieb-Linegar gas. But there's a way that the argument, I think, is that it can actually be integrable equations in between. Integrable in the sense that these are now sort of classical differential equations that are obtained from rewriting DMRG as a variational principle. I haven't checked this myself, but I believe that that is what happens. But you're right that for us, things would go haywire after some time. So, but it looks, you know, I don't think I have a picture of the real time dependence here. But our belief, for example, in this calculation, supported now by Prez and stuff, is that yeah, this is not going to suddenly go down at some much later time scale. Part of it is I could understand the occurrence. Okay, so you can always ask, is there some long time scale that we're missing because we can't go to infinite time? And the answer is, at low temperature, there could be. Because low temperature, it might be natural to get an exponentially long time scale. But at high temperature, and the surprise here is actually high temperature rather than low temperature, there's no obvious diverging time scale at high temperature. Okay, so now let me say a little bit about many-body localization. And sometimes people don't get any exposure to disorder in the standard grad school education. So let me just say a few words about one of the surprisingly open problems in the theory of localization, even in 1D. So for non-interacting systems, people understand an amazing amount about the effects of disorder. Real experimental systems have interactions. So you might worry about whether that's useful. And the answer is, it still is useful. And one reason why is that in a way, most solid-state experiments, dynamics become classical after some amount of time. Because if I'm studying the electrons, say, like electrical current, the electrons are interacting with phonons. I'm not measuring the phonons, so the phonons are like a bath. So the electronic system loses its phase coherence after some time. Localization is a result of phase coherence. So basically, you could view that, I guess, as saying that we can see sometimes nearly non-interacting localization behavior up to some time beyond which we see classical behavior. So we have learned how to treat interactions sort of perturbatively, but there is kind of a basic question about what if my system was quantum coherent for all times? So I don't have any bath of phonons, let's say. I just have the electrons, and the electrons are strongly interacting, and they're in a disordered potential. Do I expect localized behavior, which would be logical if I didn't have the interactions? I'll tell you what localization means if you haven't ever heard it in just a second. Or would I expect some kind of diffusive behavior? And the idea for diffusive behavior would be the following. Now I've got a many interacting electron system. If I look at one electron or one region of the sample, it interacts with the rest of the sample, and the rest of the sample could provide the bath that the one subsystem sees. So basically, the many-body localization transition that's suspected to exist is between localized behavior, where part of the system doesn't notice the rest, and diffusive behavior, where part of the system sees the rest of the system as the bath. But we don't actually know that that transition exists, I think. My own belief. Sorry, this slide is out of place. So this is what localization is. Basically, I want to stress that your basic intuition from quantum mechanics is not quite right in 1D. It works okay in 3D. So what I mean by your basic intuition would be, if I take a random potential, you'd say, okay, at low energy, I probably have states that are trapped in some potential minimum. At high energy, I probably have scattering states, which means they bounce every now and then, but they don't get localized. They pick up a phase shift from the potential scattering. And in 3D, that's right. And there's even one energy, the mobility edge in general, that separates localized states below that energy from extended states above that energy. Sorry, this should be extended. In 1D and 2D, the situation is different. Actually, for the simplest case of just Schrodinger equation with a random V of X, all the electronic states in 1D and 2D become localized with probability 1. Localized means that their wave functions fall off exponentially as I go to plus or minus infinity. So 1D and 2D are special because basically, if my model of a scattering state up here is a random walk, then a random walk in 1D and 2D can visit the same potential fluctuations over and over again. It visits any point sort of an infinite number of times, and it turns out that quantum mechanical interference kind of self-amplifies and turns out to be enough to give localization. So for the interacting problem, let me skip this. This is just more background on the non-interacting case. So I want to focus on the following, which is partly motivated by atomic experiments, which is just, if I take an isolated quantum system with interactions and disorder, does it show localization? And if you want to make that slightly more trendy, because most of the people doing localization are old, what a lot of young people are studying is this question, which is actually the same question in a different way of asking it, which is, if I take an isolated quantum system, does it thermalize? Because the most physical way to keep a system from thermalizing is to have it be localized, which means that if different regions are not talking to each other, then they'll equilibrate to different temperatures at best, but the whole system won't be at one temperature. So the question is, what controls localization? We understand it very well in the non-interacting case. If we turn on interactions, do we immediately get thermalization, or is there some kind of transition? And this problem, for about 6 years now, has been undergoing kind of a renaissance with various papers and disagreements and so on. So the good news is the model and the numerical technique are pretty much exactly the same as what I've been doing so far, except that now we add a bit of randomness. We're going to add a random magnetic field, which is like a random chemical potential in terms of the fermions. So the belief from people like Altschuler and Hughes and so on, and I don't really have anything to say too much for or against this belief. I want to focus on what's interesting about the localized phase. But the belief is that if I had no disorder, I'd have extended or diffusive physics, probably ballistic physics if there's strictly no disorder. Then as I turn up the disorder, so disorder is measured by the strength of the width of the distribution of the random fields. As I turn up disorder, I eventually probably get some kind of localization. And is there a many-body localization? And if so, the main reason why this is interesting is that we really have no theoretical tools for this kind of phase transition. We're kind of stuck doing numerics. So there are various ways that people have tried to look for this transition, and I'm just going to talk about basically the physics out here and how it's different from conventional Anderson localization. Then one way to look for the transition is that a localized state actually should have Poisson statistics, because two neighboring energy levels are likely to be in sort of different parts of the sample, would be the picture, which means they probably pass right through each other, while out here we'd expect the general Wigner-Dyson case, but it turns out to be hard to pinpoint a transition there. There are various other things people have tried. What I'm going to study is entanglement growth, which is kind of a measure of the beginning of thermalization. So this is a rare localization problem that's actually interesting in 1D. I think every non-interacting localization problem is solved, especially in 1D, but this problem, even in 1D, people still fight about. So the numerical experiment we can do, this is basically to use something where DMRG is more powerful than exact diagonalization. So the problem we can study is, let's take a state that has no entanglement to start with, which means it's very efficient for us to represent and deal with, and evolve it under this Hamiltonian. So that means, like, start with a product state. Then in the extended phase, we expect the entanglement grows rapidly with time. The picture for that is actually the same as the picture I drew here. If I have at least ballistically moving particles, like in a CFT, then the entanglement will be like the number of particles that have crossed that line, and that grows linearly in T. While we can study then the one particle localized phase, particles on average move the localization length, which is the size of a localized wave function, and then they stop moving, and the entanglement kind of saturates. And the interesting thing is that once you add a little bit of interactions to the localized phase, you get something that's very different from either of the standard cases. And this is the plot that kind of got us excited. So here's what happens to the entanglement as a function of time. And note that the vertical axis is not large. There's never a huge amount of entanglement over the region we can study. The horizontal axis is very large. So this is log scale. So this is, say, 1,000 in our time unit, which is at least 100 times the time after which the non-interacting problem, which is blue, has basically settled down and stopped evolving. So the story is that once you add even a little bit of interaction, then a little bit of interaction has to take a long time to take effect because of the way quantum mechanics works. But once it starts to have an effect, it increases the entanglement without stopping, basically logarithmically in time. But we can go to these very long times and it's continuing to increase. So somehow the system has developed a new diverging time scale. It's become kind of glassy. And I'll tell you the simplest picture I know for that in a second. But first, some questions you might ask. If I look at a region of the sample that's small enough that I can see it sort of saturating, it doesn't seem that the system is thermalizing to the normal ensemble, at least on the time scales we can study. So it may be, it's possible that the system is still localized, it just doesn't have the perfect saturation that the Anderson localized phase does. Things are still evolving. If I look at transport, so for example, this is a plot of something related to charge transport. It's a little bit easier to study than just the charge conductivity. There, interactions make a little bit of a change, but there's definitely no singular change. That is, there's nothing like a step function effect that we can attribute interactions. So it seems consistent with, there could be a many-body localized phase, but it's different from the Anderson localized phase. What I mean by there could be a many-body localized phase is, what we see is consistent with the conductivity still being zero. So to kind of summarize what I think are the...
How do you say it's a self, how do you detect whether it's thermalized or not thermalized?
Well, our guess was, so if we look at a, my definition of thermalized would be if I look at a reduced density matrix for a subsystem that's large enough, expectation values of local operators should look like the thermal ensemble. We don't quite see that.
What that means, do you examine
we don't do anything that thorough. So all we look at is the entropy. So the idea would be, and here, this was the idea, that if I look at a subsystem of size L, then the entanglement entropy of that subsystem, the normal way that thermalization has to work in a pure quantum system is that the entanglement entropy of the subsystem has to be the thermal entropy, because that's the only entropy that I have is the entanglement entropy. So what we see is that we get an entanglement entropy that is linear in subsystem size, so it's not an area law or anything like that. It scales like a thermal entropy, but the coefficient is much smaller than the high temperature that we would expect, given that we're starting with an arbitrary initial state, which is basically high temperature. A possibility is that the way that's kind of consistent with localization or partial localization would be, if we believe in the many-body localized phase, then energy and particle numbers should not be able to move around very much. So that means there should be, at most, like a local temperature here and a local temperature there. So it, you know, maybe there's some kind of approximate local thermalization, but the temperature is not necessarily the macroscopic temperature determined by the energy density. So that could be what's going on. I mean, it could be that there's actually no sharply defined localized phase and that what we're seeing is the beginning of a crossover. Another possibility, which is kind of in between, the main point I want to make is that The many-body localized phase cannot be just like the Anderson localized phase because it doesn't saturate in time. These two possibilities would be maybe the many-body localized phase has localized particles, or maybe it has particles that move but kind of subdiffusively, which is known to happen in 1D. For example, there's a famous model that gives distance going as log squared of t. So if you want, I think the minimal theoretical explanation for what we see, and this is connected to that work I mentioned by Dima. So my picture of the single particle localized phase is that I've got some localized states with exponential envelopes. Maybe it's easy if I put this in terms of spins, S1, S2. And I want to ask about the effective interaction between these two. Let's say that there's a time which is like 1 over the effective interaction between these two, which is the time at which I start to notice that these two spins are actually interacting and maybe forming a singlet and maybe giving me some entanglement. So that goes as 1 over whatever bare interaction I put in times the exponential of the distance between them divided by some localization length. And if I invert this, and I use the fact that entanglement seems to be going linearly with length in this model, then this will give me that the entanglement goes like the localization length times the log of J0t. And the surprise is that this simple argument, which is basically saying that what the interaction does, at least its leading order effect, is to create sort of singlets of the localized spins. They're very weakly coupled singlets, but if I wait long enough, I start to notice the entanglement from that. That actually looks a lot like our data, because what this model would predict, if I'm deep in the single particle localized phase, so that this isn't changing too much with J, then this says that the slope of the log shouldn't depend very much on J, but where I start the log should depend on J. And that's kind of true. Like, for example, between the dark green line and this cyan line or whatever it is, the interaction strength is changing by a factor of 20, and the slope is really not changing that much at all. So that's kind of consistent with the idea that the slope, and in the range of parameters we're in, we're quite disordered, so this is pretty much independent of J naught. So that's at least some picture for maybe this doesn't, you know, maybe there is a residual interaction effect. The problem with this argument is why should I be able to treat spins as a whole bunch of independent pairs? We know that they're all interacting with each other, et cetera, but at least this may be the simplest explanation I know of for the data. And this partly came out of talking with David Hughes also. So I think if I can have 5 more minutes to wrap up, it's 3 minutes till.
sure,
okay. Then I want to come back. So anyway, I've already said my conclusions in the talk, so I won't say that. I want to say a little bit about what this is good for in the quantum Hall effect, because as I said, you can go back and study some old problems. An example of a classic old problem is, how can you learn about topological order in the fractional quantum Hall effect? And you do that by trying to tunnel an electron into the edge. So at first, this sounds like a 2D problem. It's a problem of equal time correlation functions, basically. So maybe it has nothing at all to do with what I talked about before. But basically, there were some challenges in that there was a very elegant theory that most of us accept has to be the right theory. But experiments did not clearly see, for example, that there are sharp plateaus in the exponent and all that. So I'm not going to have a lot to say about the experiments, but I can say a bit about some non-trivial checks on the theory and some new things. So I'm going to focus just on the abelian quantum Hall states of fermions. So just this one little box up here, but I'm going to go to things like 1/3, 2/5, 2/3. Quantum Hall physics is very complicated, so let's start with something simple. And the reason why this is important, basically what we believe to be the correct topological field theory of the bulk was explained by Professor Wen to make a prediction about what the edge looks like. And that's basically this, that if I have this topological field theory in the bulk, so-called Chern-Simons theory, then I have chiral bosons at the edge. And this makes a specific prediction for how I should see non-Fermi liquid behavior and unusual exponents if I look at properties of the edge of a quantum Hall system. And I now want to claim that DMRG is the right way to look at this, because we can take our quantum Hall system, put it on a cylinder, put a confining potential around the cylinder. So the electrons, this is not that well drawn, but the electrons are basically sitting on the surface of the cylinder but I'm trying to confine them to the bottom half. This L is the distance around the cylinder. It's not along the cylinder. Along the cylinder is going to be infinite, which is kind of the power of this method. So if we do that, we can get the density profile, which is the blue, the confining potential is the purple. And more than that, we can check some things that I think were very hard to check with any kind of exact diagonalization study. So for example, we can put on interactions as long as they're not too long range. So we can't do Coulomb interactions, but we can show that for generic short range interactions, you get strongly non-Fermi liquid behavior. So this is the equal time electron correlation function as a function of distance along the edge. So the great thing about this method is because the distance along the edge can now be infinite, in a sense, that's the long direction, we can see power laws that are very clearly close to the quantized value predicted by the Kiro-Luttinger liquid theory, which is the dotted line. So for example, this corresponds to a slope of 3. A normal Fermi liquid would be a slope of 1. This is somehow saying that, indeed, if the two edges are far enough apart, things are very robust. The surprising result is when the edges get close together, something remains robust. But anyway, we can do other edges, multi-condensate things as well. And then just to wrap up with saying that it took us a while to understand, but we think we're starting. Normally, the picture for the way this works, so this is basically trying to use methods and ideas that we know about for one-dimensional metals. Because once I've got my quantum Hall edges, this is just a one-dimensional metal, which means it's a conformal field theory probably, so we can use all those fancy methods. What do I learn about quantum Hall states, or what do I learn about one-dimensional metals from making this kind of connection? So that is to say, when I stick this into the DMRG algorithm, it's just a funny one-dimensional Hamiltonian. It has somewhat unusual interaction terms and all that because it's coming from mapping a two-dimensional problem using Landau orbitals that are like circles, but it's still some one-dimensional problem. If it's got edges, that means it's a 1D metal. And the answer is that when the two edges get close to each other, I lose the exponent quantization, which is what I'm supposed to do. But there's something that remains, and it's kind of like saying that the Luttinger theorem, which is the idea, Luttinger's theorem, just to remind you, well, it's not exactly a theorem, but so that's why it's in quotes, Luttinger's theorem, is that when I turn on interactions, I don't change the location of the Fermi surface. In other words, I don't change the singular points in N of K. So for example, in that XXZ plot I showed you at the very beginning of the talk, the N of K distribution, where the singularity is not changing with the Luttinger parameter. Here, it turns out that I think this was written down by Haldane in some lecture notes, but it was totally inaccessible at the time. If you look at these 1D effective Hamiltonians, if I take the 1D effective Hamiltonian that's related, for example, to the 2/5 quantum Hall state, then the filling of that one-dimensional Hamiltonian is related to the location of the two singularities of N of K, which are now funny sort of discontinuities of the derivative, with these magic numbers 3 and 15 that are numbers that appear in the hierarchy description of the 2/5 state. So what this says is that the standard Luttinger's theorem is just one possibility. There's kind of a set of allowed cases. It's like there's a fractional Luttinger theorem, and at least all the abelian quantum Hall states we know, in general, for every condensate, there's one more singularity of the N of K distribution, and they are mapped with some coefficients onto the filling. And this seems to be more robust than the edge exponents, which are non-universal once the wire is finite. So this is kind of saying people occasionally talk about fractional quantum Hall physics in a wire. We suspect, although we haven't written the paper yet, so things can always go wrong, but we suspect that the right way to define what is fractional quantum Hall-like physics in a wire is this sort of fractional Luttinger theorem, that there are singularities in the N of K distribution, but those singularities are not the standard Luttinger theorem. They have some quantized rational coefficients, and we understand how that works for hierarchy states, at least. So I thought that would be fun just to kind of present something that we don't really understand yet. Fully, but I think that is where I'll stop. So, thank you.
Sitting at the Heisenberg point, suppose you introduce a random magnetic field. Then in the absence of the field, you have zero spin-ons. Now, once you put small field, the ground state, it adds spin-ons. And then residual coupling forms singlets. there is a hierarchy of them. Is that the picture you are developing?
Well, actually, yeah. So the Heisenberg point, this would open a gap. So it turns out that the point, the anti-ferromagnetic Heisenberg point, this would open a gap. At the ferromagnetic point, it wouldn't. So this is a relevant perturbation at the anti-ferromagnetic point, but irrelevant. So we kind of focused on what it does in the irrelevant case. What it does in the relevant case, I know that it opens a gap, but more than that, I don't know.
I see. Random magnetic field at the Heisenberg point opens a gap.
At the Heisenberg anti-ferromagnetic point opens a gap.
I see.
You can kind of see that, I guess, because the staggered correlation is falling off like 1 over R. And I think that will give you that this is a relevant perturbation because it couples to that correlation.
But still, there may be some density of mid-gap states because it's random. And they may be...
Oh, sorry. The random case. Sorry, I thought you meant
random.
I thought you meant the
Euphorb
case. I guess, okay, let me think about that. Okay, the limit that we've thought about is when the disorder is stronger than the interactions, because we wanted to start in the many-body localized phase where the entanglement is small. So what you're asking about is kind of if I went to the Heisenberg point, which is the most strongly interacting, and then turned on weak disorder.
There will be localized spin-ons.
I think so. I mean, that kind of disorder, that's basically, yeah. Weak disorder in a Luttinger liquid, you get this sort of Giamarchi-Schultz picture. Where, yeah, it's, I think the belief is that, you can understand it in terms of the Luttinger liquid, and yeah, those excitations you could identify as spin-ons if you want, and they do become localized. Okay. Any other questions?
Yeah, so in the first part, when you described this new conserved quantity, the pros and found, is there any intuition about what that is?
Looking at the form of it, I think there's intuition about the way he found it and why it hadn't been found before. So it's somehow, it's almost connected to why it would appear here. So if you just have a closed, people had mostly thought about a closed ring in studying the XXE model. And then there isn't really any very simple way to get that quantity in that geometry. If you think about either a ring with one impurity or open boundary conditions are kind of like a dramatic impurity in a ring where you've just cut one bond. Then it was thinking about what is the response to the modification of one bond, if you like, or the response to a change in boundary conditions. He sort of figured, well, with one site, he could make something that was kind of interesting, and then you could commute with that and get something on the second site. So you get this process where you get a complicated expression that kind of is working in from the boundary, involving terms on every site that do decay, but not especially rapidly. So people sometimes call it quasi-local. But it's, you know, we don't have any explicit expression for it. We just have a procedure where you can construct a longer and longer polynomial, but less and less local approximation to it. But it was basically discovered by trying to construct something related to the boundary condition in an iterative way to keep fixing the non-commutation of the previous level. So that's pretty operational as far as what it means on some deeper level. I don't know.
If I can see this species as a fractional, if you see this species as a fractional quantum pool in a wire, is there some like a fractional statistics of ground state units in this wire?
I think ground state degeneracy is quite possible, but it kind of winds up being hard to make interesting. So what I mean is, if I take this geometry, whenever I compactify one direction of a fractional quantum Hall problem, I get a weak charge density wave. It gets exponentially weak as this size gets large. But that's kind of saying there is a threefold degeneracy of the ground state, for example, in the Laughlin case, but it's the 1D picture of that degeneracy is that it's just coming from a charge density modulation that's changing the unit cell. So that wouldn't explain this Luttinger thing, but so I think there's a ground state degeneracy, but it's not that exciting. Statistics, yeah, this is an interesting thing. So Dunghai Li is one of the people that really worked recently on this one-dimensional analogy, and I worked on kind of the early stages, but he drove it much further. And he, I think, and Alex Seidel came up with kind of a representation of something like fractional statistics, even though it's 1D, where the only statistics you really have, normally, the problem in 1D is that you can't distinguish braiding from a collision because you have to move the particles through each other. But they claim, and I don't really understand it, that there is a sense in which the one-dimensional models that you do get from this have at least some kind of exclusion statistics or something like that that makes sense in 1D. So there's a claim about statistics, but we haven't looked at it. But it's in papers by Alex Seidel and Doug Hiley.
Questions? Let's thank our speaker again.